today I'm really excited to introduce you to one of my dearest friends and mentors and someone that's got a lot to do with where I am today. And it's Dr. Tomo. He is, as many of you in yachting know, one of the most amazing doctors, very well known in yachting. He's probably been on the end of the phone to you guys in the past. Those of you that have done the America's Cup or been there, he was out there in the rib, making sure everyone was safe. He does some training with me. He's trains all the Volvo guys for the Volvo Ocean Race, and so much more. Also very active in the lifeguards. But you should introduce yourself, Dr. Tomo. Say hi to the Yachting International Radio crew.
Hi, man. Well, great to be here. Great to be, on the radio with you. That's fantastic. And well, you've been very kind and very generous in what you've said. I don't see myself as any of those things. I see myself as a sort of a GP. I live and work and play in handball, and I've been a GP here now for 28 years. But I'm lucky enough to have been involved in the sailing world before that, and continue to do so. And I suppose it all goes back to when I first started sailing on big boats. I was lucky enough to get a ride on one of the Whitbread boats in 89. I didn't do the race, but I did a good 4 or 5 months before the race on a boat called NCB Ireland, and got a good good experience of what it's like out at sea. And when that race went off, and that was, of course, the famous Steinlager and Fisher and Paykel race, and, fantastic boats and 13, 15 entries, I think, more maybe. And I suddenly started thinking about the medical side of it, and actually, who was in charge and how it happened and how it ran. Prior to that, Peter Blake had always said that there should be a doctor on every boat. But that was really before telemedical support came in. And I suppose the first big campaign I did as the medic on shore was with Peter Blake and Robin Knotts Johnson on ENSA when they went off around the world on the Jules Verne trophy. And I put the medical kit together for them and was on the end of a phone for them. But of course, in those days, it was so different to now. I mean, nowadays, you're just, your iPhone goes off and they send you photographs. But back then, they would ring me via Porter's Head radio on SSB radio, and it would come through to your old-fashioned, phone on your desk, and you'd have to speak like you're on a radio. And I still remember that first time when they rang me from the Southern Ocean, and Peter had hurt himself quite badly, and I was giving advice, but I had this 18-year-old in the consultation room who'd wanted to come in to go on the pill, and I had to interrupt her and talk to these people in the Southern Ocean, and she just thought I was slightly mad. So I've been really lucky to be involved, in sailing from that time on, and the medical aspects of sailing. As you very kindly said, I've been involved in the Whitbread and Volvo for 25-something years, designing the medical kits and doing the training with the crews, who've become incredibly competent. And you look at some of them over the years, just Chris Mason and Tony Ray come to mind as two guys who are really just yachties, but, they were really competent at analysing situations and making good calls and good judgments about when people were unwell or just, not so unwell, and they could patch them up there and then. And they were sort of two of the guys that I would always talk about as how competent you can become. If you, take it seriously, you train hard at it and enjoy it and see that part of it. And it's certainly been, a part of the race. I mean, I think we go back to, I'm trying to remember the name of the boat. When we had to ditch one of the crew secretly in the middle of the night because he had infected kneecap, and they went into stealth mode and dropped him off in the I think it was in the Azores. So that none of the other crews knew about. And that was quite fun being involved in that, because we knew what was going on and none of the media or any of the other crews know about that. And nowadays, as I said, Mandy, they just ring you up on your iPhone and they ping you photographs from wherever they are in the world. And that's just it's a really cool way of communicating with them now. And so you can be there, you know, with them. And I suppose the thing that I've enjoyed is that I can understand the situations they're in. I remember Brian Thompson on the Vonday cutting his hand open quite badly. So he's single-handed. So straight away, you're thinking about what he can do for himself, you know, in those conditions that he's in, and whether it needs stitching, gluing, stapling or steri-stripping all depends on so many things about the boat, the conditions, you know, how many people, the competency of the guys involved. And he, funnily enough, I was talking him through gluing this cut back together again. And then I realized that he'd dropped the phone on the floor and he'd glued his good fingers to his cut with the glue. So he couldn't actually turn the phone off. And he had to turn the phone off with his foot because he'd managed to glue his fingers to the wound, which is a really common thing when you're using glue for the first time.
It sure is. It's not just the first time either.
And so he rang me back later to say all had gone well. So it was, yeah, that was quite an amusing moment. But there's lots of stories about being involved. I'm rabbiting on, but I, you know, the America's Cup, being involved in that, and I was lucky enough to Ian rang me and asked me to get involved in the training of all the crews for the last America's Cup. So I was quite involved in that, and setting up protocols for the drivers, all the support boats, and what they needed and what expertise they needed. And that was really interesting. I'll let you talk, Mandy. Sorry, I've been rabbiting.
No, not at all. But you actually led into the next question, because I was lucky enough to be your co-medic out there at the America's Cup when we were in Southampton off Cowes. And you did a lot more than me. You organised it all and did all the events. And to be there right on the line, you know, we had a really comprehensive medical kit and a lot of responsibility, you know, because, you know, to be at the forefront of yachting as we are as medics is so exciting. But the technology of sailing, you know, like last America's Cup was phenomenal with the boats. But this year, you know, I was watching an America's Cup boat in New Zealand the other day, in Team New Zealand, and they were racing along, and their chase boat was going alongside and couldn't even keep up with it. And the boat's up on foils. And, you know, so what are we prepared for in times like that? What are our biggest risks for those crew?
I mean, I got involved I'm involved in Sail GP as well, which, as you know, is the 75s, the 50s, the foiling 50s, that are all, you know, Larry's put together, that whole squad. And I was most recently involved with that, with Chris Reed, who's a New Zealand doctor, great guy, but he's ex, you know, just to say, I think he's ex-SBS, so he's army trained, and the kit we had on board and the expertise we had on board, I mean, I was there just as a sort of an advisor in some ways. But I think it goes to show that when we're out on the water, we're trying to see what possibly could happen. I mean, the biggest worry for us was the foils, and they're traveling at such high speed that if sadly, as we know, it's happened to a French skipper who fell over, and the foil on the rudder cut his ankle very, very badly, and he was lucky to keep his foot. And as we know, also foils have gone through ribs and damaged spectators incredibly badly. So that's a really big worry. But of course, they then put in the safety tethers that all the crew have, so that no longer becomes an issue. But when these boats are de-accelerating, when they hit a wave badly, it's really like a 30-mile-an-hour car crash. And we had that with the Chinese boat in Cowes last summer, when two of the crews banged into each other and banged into the pedestal. And really, you know, they looked, you know, I went to look after them, and they were pretty shaken up and beaten up. And it wasn't just sort of, you know, a little bag of ice and they're back on the boat the next day. They were out of action for, you know, the rest of the regatta. And these are really fit, strong guys who, you know, can absorb these sort of impacts, but they're just, you know, they're just broken and bruised so badly because of the impact. So I think, you know, what's been clever, I think, now is that we're designing boats with the medicine in mind. We're beginning to think about what we have to do. And we look back to the Volvo boats, you know, and I remember, you know, talking with people and designers about, you know, having, you know, where you have the handholds down below, where you have the foam padding down below, and making it part of the so that it was mandatory that the winches that, you know, were whirring away down below decks were all padded so that they wouldn't, you know, crash their head on them and cause big head injuries. So it's been really fun being part of that. The next set, I mean, I can't wait to see the monohulls, you know, foiling around, and I think that's yet another, you know, there's more crew, more speed, more potential. I mean, when we were out on the water in Cowes with the 8 sail GP boats, I mean, there were 3 medical teams out on the water, all who had a diver on board with, you know, oxygen or air available at any one time for any crew member who was caught underwater. We had, you know, stretchers, we had oxygen, we had plenty of medication if it was required. But the biggest thing for us was all of us keeping our eyes open all the time as to what potential injuries could happen. The one thing we don't want to see is a T-bone, two boats hitting each other. I think we're all pretty worried about that. That could be really uncomfortable for any of the crew. And you know, we'd have to be in there straight away and assess the damage. And I think that's what Chris, Reed, the other doctor and myself were, what we were quite, we they all, when we were talking to the organizers, they're saying, well, what can happen? What do you want us, you know, do you want a helicopter? Do you want this? And we said, we'll let you know at the time. And I think that's where the experience that he and I had comes in, is that we can make assessments quite quickly. We can triage, as we call it, quite quickly as to what it is we need. And it will all depend on so many things, the wave condition, the wind direction will all have an effect on what decisions we make as to how to manage these crew members, whether we can manage them on the boat, whether we need to fly them off, rib them off, whatever it is. So that's what's fun. That's what I enjoy about it. Slightly intellectual thought process going in, as well as the practical hands-on, you know, looking after the guys.
That's what I find amazing too, because it's never going to be the situation you train for when there's so many factors and elements involved. You know, from my understanding, marine medicine, when it comes to these high performance race yachts, we're getting the research from the Formula One with the loads, and people don't realize how much load is in the sails, you know, and people don't realize that if a top of a winch comes off, which, you know, probably wouldn't happen, especially in Mallorca, but you know, or a rope breaks or a block breaks, you know, there's so much load attached to those pieces of machinery, you know, and those mechanics, that it can do serious damage. And even when you see a sheet flicking around, you know, that could flick someone up 30 feet in the air and then they could land on the deck. And a lot of people that don't go high-performance sailing don't realise the loads involved in you know, in this type of yachting.
No, it's amazing. I mean, I as I said, I was lucky enough to sail on the old, really old Whitbread, you know, Maxis, and we had wire sheets. You know, we had, you know, for the number, you know, 3 and 4 jib, we had, you know, these were wire to rope, you know, splices. And watching them, you know, and the loading strains on those boats was huge because they were so heavy and relatively slow. And then we went through a period, I think, of slightly less loads, but now we're back up, you know, they're doing such high numbers and the loadings are huge. And that's what, you know, these guys are, you know, it's why they're super fit, why they have to be super fit. But they're also, you know, have become experienced in this and managing it and being aware of it and putting themselves in the right position. But a crash on one of these, you know, either the new America's Cup boats or the old Sail GP boats, that's going to be, you know, quite impressive. But I'm, as you mentioned earlier, lucky enough to be, you know, still on call for an awful lot of boats around the world, and I, you know, as well as the America's Cup, I still love the, you know, you get these the phone calls from the Southern Hemisphere or the South Pacific, and you've got people with jellyfish bites, or they've been, you know, bit by a shark, and you know, and you know, a good friend of yours, I always remember the story, a good friend of yours in Mallorca who got, they caught a marlin over the side of the boat, and the fish didn't like it and put the nose straight through this guy's, who's a rigger in Palma, put his nose through the calf, and they rang me up about what to do, and I just was giggling on the phone because, you know, he's still got a slight scar, but he's still walking and cycling quite efficiently these days. So, you know, and it's nice when you catch up with these guys, you know, later on, and they show you their war wounds that they've fixed themselves. I remember being on a J boat. I was lucky enough to sail on a J boat once, and one of the lads cut his head open quite badly, and I was there, and I could have easily done it, but it was like, well, there's no point me doing it. Why not get one of the crew to do it, who's going to need to do it in the round the world race? So, you know, watching him do it and teaching him through it in real life, you know, when we're out at sea and, you know, bouncing around a bit, you know, that's very rewarding. And I've always enjoyed that and still enjoy that if I can do that, be part of that.
And I'll never forget, that's one of the first lessons you taught me back in 2004, I think, when we first met. And you and I, you were helping me put together some medical kits for actually my husband's boat, who I wasn't even dating at the time, and a couple of my best friends. And I said, oh, what about some cannulas and this and that? And I remember you saying to me, like, Amanda, you know, I know you're a pretty good trauma nurse, but can you cannulate like in the Bay of Biscay? Would you be able to, you know, and you're trained for it. You're like vampire, but how are these crews supposed to even get a drip in the, you know, and we think we can have this equipment, and it's one thing to have it on board and to be trained on it, but especially when it comes to sailing, when we don't have stabilizers, you know, and the boat's going around like this in so many places, you know, we've got a lot of swell to deal with. And when, you know, things happen, it's often dark, and, you know, we've lost electronics and there's big swells. So getting, you know, using these tools and getting drips in and doing stitches in the conditions that we've got to do it in sometimes isn't like in the training room or like in the, you know, very controlled hospital environments that we work in.
And I, you know, I'll reiterate that. I always remember one of the poor lads. I mean, there were four of them on a Volvo Open 60 coming back across from America. And they got caught out really badly. And the two guys on deck were fine. But the two guys down below got slammed from one side to the other side. And one of them broke his arm, his humerus, beautiful fracture. And the other guy shattered his kneecap in 15 places. And they rang me at about 3 a.m. And I sort of like was doing a bit of an assessment. And they were still in 50 knots of breeze. And all I could hear was as the wind was howling. And I was there thinking, you know, well, ideally, you know, there's a bit of my brain that's still sort of, you know, hospital based, and, you know, and then I was thinking, okay, what am I going to do for them there and then? And so it's very much managing the situation that they're in, visualizing what you can do. So I really, what I do is I close my eyes and I try and be them. So I try and be the guy who's terrified. You know, there's one guy, you know, steering the boat, and there's other guy trying to, you know, look after these two injured guys. And I'm trying to, you know, work with him. So I close my eyes and I just talk him through what he can do there and then at that time, how he can manage the situation. And really, you're there as a big brother. You're looking after them as well as being the doc. And I think those guys I spoke to pretty much two or three times a day for the next 5 days until they got to the Azores. And they were really, really struggling by that stage. There were, you know, they'd been two men down only out of four, and, you know, bringing two injured guys back. And they were like, we want a helicopter. And I go, you ain't going to get a helicopter because they only do 150 miles and you're still, you know, you're still 1500 miles, you know, from shore. So, you know, we've got to work with this.
And that's something people don't understand. So many people that I train, you know, in the past have said, oh, let's call the helicopter. And first of all, there's the mileage. And secondly, when you've got a big mass that's going back and forth, you know, from the research I've read, it's only 5% of helicopter rescues are actually successful.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy thing for anybody. So the helicopter crews or the crew on the boat. So, and you have to, you know, it's incredibly expensive and you have to keep it for the right people. So being involved in those assessments. And but what is great with communication is that we can really look after these people well, you know, safely. And we can make on, you know, we can update and, you know, we can have, you know, decisions. And you know, I've worked with Dr. Briggs at MSOS for many years. And between us, we've made some very good decisions and looked after some people, you know, out at sea who've been pretty unwell. And we've got them to where they need to be, you know, hopefully in good shape. So it's been very rewarding, you know, part of my career. Yes, I love it still. I love being involved and, you know, I'm still doing a bit of sailing, but not as much as I'd like to. But still doing medicine for sure, Amanda.
Another thing, just before we wrap up, that a huge part of your expertise that we haven't even touched on, and something that you've always really inspired me in, is that you got to be a doctor in Antarctica, and more the yachts, you know, are going, you know, my fascination with the Arctic and Antarctic and following in your footsteps and trying to get down there and studying at university level. The more and more boats are going through the Northwest Passage down to Antarctica. I think by the time I finish my master's, there won't be an Antarctic. But anyway, you've always really inspired me. I remember you lent me a book on Antarctic medicine. And could you tell us a bit about that? Because so many yachties even on sailing boats are going down to Antarctica now. So what are we dealing with down there when we're so remote? There's no helicopters there, right?
There's no helicopters there. I mean, I was lucky enough to work as a doctor on a very small little cruise ship, passenger from Ushuaia down to the peninsula of Antarctica. And I went across the Drake Passage 4 times. And unbelievably, it never was more than about 25 knots of breeze. So I didn't never really experienced a real full-on gale down there. But when you're down on the peninsula, I think the remoteness really hits home just how far away you are. And just how self-sufficient you have to be in managing your problems. So it is, you know, it's the 5 P's that we always talk about. You know, preparation and planning prevents poor performance. And it's looking at, you know, making sure that you're fit and healthy before you go down there, making sure you prevent problems. And I think that's really the biggest thing in the high altitudes is preventing the problems is just thinking about what you're going to be doing, you know, in the next 2 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, 4 hours and a few days. So, you know, you read the stories and you know, these people who take their gloves off when it's, you know, chill factor of minus 30 and they get frost nip symptoms. And then the whole thing escalates and you get more and more problems and you get infections. So it's really preventing the problems before they occur and then, you know, making sure that you deal with those problems as soon as they occur so they don't get worse and worse and worse. And I think, you know, when you're there, you begin to understand that and you begin to see that you just have to be really sensible. And some yachties, you know, that they aren't, you know, they grew up doing, you know, whatever, the Admiral's Cups and things like that. And you took risks because that was what won you the races. But down there, you can't do that. You have to think, you know, in a differently, much more logical, much more structured way. And I think Skip Novak, if anyone gets the chance to listen to him or to read his books, I mean, he is, you know, the legend that is Skip Novak and has such a good understanding of the conditions there and the medical problems. He and I have had lots of good chats about things down there. But again, communications are better now. You know, we can communicate most of the time with the rest of the world when we're down there. I'd love to go back down there, Amanda. You know, one day I really would, because it is the most beautiful place I've ever been in the world. It's fantastic. It's awe-inspiring for sure.
Wow, amazing. Yeah. And do you think we're equipped, these boats are equipped enough to be down there for prolonged periods of time with the kits we've got? Because obviously we've got the issue of space. You know, I find when I'm on boats, it's so easy to want to say, oh, you need to get this and this and that and that, but we can't turn them into a hospital. And it's a quite a tricky
thing.
If you were taking a 200-foot boat down to Antarctica, exploring sailing boat, with 10 crew, what would be the minimum kit you would go with?
Well, I mean, without going into the specifics of it, I think you have to look at who you're taking down there. I mean, you know, how fit they are, what you're doing down there. But you have to be prepared for, you know, if they're going to do some ski orienteering or some climbing, you have to be prepared for fractures. So you have, you know, looking at those things. So you have to take equipment that you can, you know, whether you take a stretcher. But yachties, Amanda, yachties are really good at compromising and what is the word I'm looking for? They can make things up as they go along. So they can...
Totally resourceful, yeah.
They cut the bunk out and, you know, they cut one of the pipe cots out and use that as a stretcher if they need to. Yeah. So I think we can put too much stuff on boats down there. And as you said earlier, unless they know what they're going to do with it, there is no point in them having it. I mean, I remember a discussion with an orthopedic surgeon once. He wanted to put a cricothyroidotomy kit on board a boat. And I was like, no, you know, they'll kill the bloke before they, you know, do a cryco. So, you know, I think that was one level where he said, but we need to be seen, you know, to have everything. And I go, I don't think we do. I think we're quite safe the way we are. And I think I've been proven right over the years. So I think they have to have kit that they're familiar with, and they have to have kit that they know what they're doing with. Otherwise, they'll cause more problems. I think the other thing that is different now, apart from in some really remote parts of the world, is there are other ships around. There are always other resources available. So, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, there's a cruise ship within about 100 miles of wherever you are, and they have amazing facilities. And that's now becoming much more common in the Antarctic, is there is, you know, some pretty big cruise ships. And they have got a mini hospital on the boat because they have to for legal reasons. Mm-hmm. So the communication and the, you know, maybe we can't get them, but we can divert people and to other ships. And we've done that in the past, and so that they can be then looked after. That doesn't mean to say you're sensible going with a plaster and a paracetamol, but it does mean to say that you don't have to take a hospital on the ship. I think, but that's one of the great games that we play all the time is, you know, what's safe? People ask me all the time, and there's never a definitive answer. It's because every situation is different. Every boat's different. It's made up of different people, you know. The 70 or 80 year old, the octogenarians who are, you know, taking time off and using their children's inheritance to go sailing around the world may need a different kit from the 35 year old sports people. So it's great. I mean, I've really enjoyed that thought process that goes into that.
Amazing. So I've got one more question. If you were to get offered the most amazing trip ever, as a medic, so you could be looking after a certain race, you could be on the boat, you could be doing it, you could be in the headquarters helping out. What would be the be all and end all that would really be the cream of the crop? Because you've had an epic career, and I definitely am trying to follow in your footsteps as much as I can. So if you could do anything in terms of marine medicine or expedition medicine, because you've done, we could talk forever about all the amazing expeditions you've done as well as sailing, but if you could do, yeah, the craziest thing ever in terms of expedition medicine, what would it be?
I think back to the Antarctic, Amanda. It's just the most beautiful place. I think the most beautiful boats I've sailed on are the old boats. Mariquita was my favorite boat I've ever sailed on. I was lucky to sail on J boats for a bit, and they were amazing. But no, the Antarctic. To get back down to the Antarctic and be, to be involved down there and to do some expedition medicine down there. I did some expeditions in, as you said, in Borneo and Chile, and they were interesting in their own rights and fantastic. But the Antarctic, for me, yeah, I'd go back down there in a heartbeat if someone offered me a job down there. Yeah.
Would you go there on a J boat?
No. I'll go down with Skip. For me, that's the ultimate, I think, because I think that I remember being on this little, it was only a 300 foot, it wasn't a big boat at all, and there was not great equipment. And I was thinking, and I did do some scenarios in my head about what I'd do if, you know, this happened or that happened. And about a month after I came back, one of the bigger boats, they crashed a helicopter and they had quite some major trauma. And I went through all that in my head. And they had some burns and some trauma. And I was like going, okay, you know, there's always that bit of you. It's like, oh, I'm glad I wasn't there. But there's a bit of you which was like, yeah, it would have been interesting to see how you cope in those situations and what you do and how you manage that. And, you know, for all of us, you know, that's why we train. We want to be pushed. We don't want people to be hurt, of course, but we want to be pushed a little bit in the management of these things. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much. Because you're a medical professional and still active in your career, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say on radio where you are and where to find you, but
you can, they can find me. I mean, you know, people are welcome to find me. I'm a GP in Hamble and always welcome to for advice. Yeah.
And you do ENG ones, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do plenty of those. So yeah, you're welcome to come and find me for those. Amanda can put you in touch with me.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. It's such an honor to have you.
Silly. You're the inspiration to all of us, Amanda, to just take your dreams and go with them. And that's what we've seen with you, is just how, you know, you're living the dream. You've wanted to do something and you're doing it. And that's an inspiration to anyone listening, is just to see this lady just, you know, fulfill the dreams that she wants and inspire the rest of us with her amazing achievements. So I'm just a jobbing GP in Hamble, lucky enough to have met some right people at the right times.
Yeah, so if anyone is taking a J class down to Antarctica, give me a call. I'm only joking. All right, thanks so much, Tomo, and thanks everyone to listening to the show.
All right, bye now.